Thanks. Adrian asked me to give kind of a wide background. There's always the tendency you want to talk about the newer stuff. So I made the background a little long, and if you ask a lot of questions, it means that I should go over it, and if you don't ask questions, I can get more into the new stuff, so it's completely up to you. Which means I actually encourage you to ask and not be polite or anything. So this is the thing I want to talk about today. This is the joint activity of a little over 100 ganglion cells from a salamander retina responding to a natural movie. This is about 10 seconds long. Every line here is one neuron. And the question that bothers us is, how do you read this code? And although it's just a little bit silly, but still, if you just count the number of possible patterns over the 100 cells, just asking which one was spiking, which one was silent, you have 2 to the 100 patterns. This is how big a number this is. And so if you want to make sense of the code here, of what's actually being sent by the retina to the brain by this sequence, it's not about how long of an experiment you run, because it's not like you're ever going to get anywhere near sampling what the distribution is about. It's not about how big of a computer you have to analyze the data. It's really about figuring out some of the underlying structures that control what the whole group is doing together. And so the questions I want to talk about today are mostly about can we try and identify some of the design principles of how these networks or large groups are organized. Maybe ask questions about why is it built this way? What would be the smart way to build such a code, and or what can we learn from how the code looks like? And something about how we might actually be able to read that code, and also what this implies for how the brain can actually read its own code. So just to put everybody on the same page, the fundamental issue with describing the activity patterns of even single neurons, but definitely with many neurons, is the fact that neurons are very, very noisy. So if you repeat, or maybe very, very noisy is too strong of a claim, but neurons are noisy. And so if you repeat a stimulus many, many times, you get spike patterns which are differ depending on the kind of the stimulus and the kind of the system that you look at. And if you were to discretize times in small enough bins, and think of a binary representation of spiking versus no spiking, then if you look at what happens at a specific point in time, you'll see that for the same stimulus, you can get different binary words or responses from the neuron. This would be the encoding side of the way the code works. And if you ask yourself, well, what have I learned when I've seen a specific pattern coming out of a specific neuron, say this four-letter word, then you can ask, well, we know that many different stimuli could have resulted in that very pattern. And so the fundamental way to try and think about these things is to kind of decipher the nature of this probabilistic dictionary or the probabilistic code. So we have to rely on probability distributions. And so kind of an example, this is retinal data, which is most of what I'll talk about today. This is from Michael Berry's lab in Princeton. And so these are three different kinds of stimuli that they showed to the retina. Every red box here, I hope you can see this, is one neuron responding to multiple repetitions of the stimulus. And so while on a relatively long time scale, you had a sense that the neurons are very reliable and they kind of respond in very clear times along the stimulus, if you were to zoom on different things or kind of focus on what happens even on even larger time scale for natural stimuli, you see that there's actually high variability. And in fact, it becomes even more apparent how noisy things are where you use natural stimuli rather than artificial ones, which is part of why we really wanted to focus on natural stimuli. OK? So, sorry? Very little. They do, but they're nothing like what you see in mammals. So this is the, so here, this is a recording from the array on the dish, so it's not about the saccades. Sorry, so you're asking if this is the result of saccades kind of.
Image that is generated by the Kali 9.
So this is not matched for saccadic eye movement. This is salamander retina. Salamander retina?
Salamander.
Yeah.
Sorry?
I don't know. So why the retina? So you've heard yesterday and the day and the few days before that, and there's be more in Steve's talk. But for our purposes, this is a very neat system to try and ask, you know, basic questions about population codes, mostly because it's so well studied that we know a lot about the circuitry. It's a relatively simple as far as circuits go in terms of how things look like. From Maslin's characterization of types, you get a feeling that you can really think about Lego block-like structures and figure out, you know, what these different cells do. Somehow they don't have a starburst amacrine cell among all these amacrine cells here. It's a multi-layered network, and as we've seen many times, it's doing very non-trivial computations from direction-selective responses to prediction, to adaptation, to different kind of statistics in the stimuli, and so forth. And so this is how the experimental setup that I'm going to show you data from. This is from Michael Berry's lab in Princeton, and the newer stuff comes from Ronen Segev's lab in Ben-Gurion University in Israel. So this is the array recording system that Marcus Meister pioneered, where you peel the retina off the eye of the animal, you project a movie on the retina that sits on the electrode array, and you can sort the spiking of many, many cells simultaneously. And this is how this looked like in a kind of a dense array, where you can label the cell bodies and see the axons and the cell bodies next to the tips of the electrodes. And I'm going to show you data from a salamander, a guinea pig, and an archerfish. I think today, basically all of the results are similar for all these different species. It's not a guinea pig. It's a guinea pig with issues, what can I tell you? So if you look at even single cells, you find that the natural way we look at things by classifying cells into types and classes has a very different picture when you actually look at how they respond to different kind of stimuli. So you can map the receptive field properties or the spike target average or the spike target covariance, anyone that you like better, for the different kinds of cells, and you find differences that you need to kind of assign for yourself a metric to decide which kind of response properties are really similar rather than the functional classification like on and off cells and fast on cells and so forth. But you can also try and really quantify how much information different cells carry, even of the same type. So you go back to the binary patterns that we had before, and you can quantify the relation between the responses of the cells to the stimulus as the difference between the entropy of the distribution of the words, which tells you how rich their vocabulary is, and the entropy of the responses over multiple repeats of the same stimulus, which is a measure of how noisy that response is. So this will be the difference between two terms here. And if you plot the information rates of different neurons for different kind of movies, so these are all natural movies, but it looks very similar for other ones. Every dot here is one neuron. The color of the neuron tells you something about the way it would be usually classified in terms of its functional type. And you can see that basically for neurons from the same class, they basically span many different orders of magnitude in terms both of their firing rate and their how much information they carry about the movie. And this is true for, again, different kinds of movies. So the information rate actually depends. I mean, what you'll get will be there's some sensitivity to the actual how fine the bin that you're going to take. So usually you would try and make it as small as you can and still sample things reliably. In terms of this diversity, then no, this doesn't go away when you make the bins larger. So. Yes? So the exponent, again, is not that sensitive to the bin size. We've been playing a lot with, at some point, trying to figure out why this would make sense as the right scaling. We did similar, I mean, kind of in past life, we did similar estimations for the information rate that H1 neuron in the different flies carry about the stimulus, and then we find linear scaling, and this is also what Axel Borst found. But I don't know why this would be the sensible thing. I guess this has a lot to do with energy issues, but that's just. No. No, so I don't actually have the slide, but we've done this for many different kind of movies, and this is, seems to be very. So the information. It's similar. I wouldn't say it's universal, but it's similar. There was another question there. So this is kind of taking the limit of infinitely long words, so you're trying to estimate the information rate. So you kind of take longer and longer words and trying to extrapolate what would be the rate for, you know, very long words. Then I don't remember the exact number. Yes.
Can I just intuit you like you're saying that the cells that fire at a lower rate have a sloppier timing?
Have a sloppier timing?
So the spike is not
so the bits for spike give you a sense, but it's not necessarily that, you know, the low rate ones are much sloppier. I mean, there are cases when they can be very accurate. So the question is, you know, by how do you normalize the the sloppiness? When you normalize by the firing rate? I mean, what's the, how do you actually quantify that?
If the slow one were as precise as the fast one,
yeah,
then you would get a lot of bits per second.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. Well, they could be less reliable, but there's also the fact that there is catchy correlations between the spikes, and so this actually, some of them are kind of more redundant, so it's not completely clean in that sense. Yes? So here, this was done, for different scales, from going from 2 milliseconds to 30 milliseconds or so. It doesn't really matter all that much. So this is what you see at level of single cells, and of course, we all like single neurons, but most of what we really care about comes from the activity of many cells. And so the notion of what cells do together is kind of goes back to the very first days of recordings. And there are very clear cases, many examples, when you find correlated activity between neurons that is has very clear behavioral correlate or what I would like to think of kind of relation. And so this is one example from Hatsopoulos from a few years back, but there are many others in which this is a monkey performing a reaching task, and you look at two neurons, and this will be their preferred direction, the two arrows here, and you actually find that if you look at the correlations, the preferred correlation actually goes somewhere in the middle between these two arrows and actually is higher than what you would expect just naively from the product of the two cells. And you can go and actually estimate how much information you get from this event, which is very different from what you would get from every cell and so on. You can find other examples. This is a go-no-go test from Reed et al., again, many years ago already, that kind of looks at the joint spiking of cells and actually sees with respect to different parts of the complicated go-no-go task with holding and period for the monkey, that you can actually find cases where there's joint firing. This will be these red spots over here, which really also predict whether the animal is going to make a go or no-go movement. And you can actually see correlates of that even before some of the signals in the experiment actually being shown. So this kind of clear state-dependent behavior, which you can see at the level of the correlation of the cells, and there are, of course, many other examples I just speak to. And so what you kind of seem to be getting from many of these examples is that you can think, okay, so I can look for many, many correlated interesting pairs that do signify cool stuff about the animal. But the thing is that when you look at the correlations, in many papers, you find that, you know, it's very rarely to find cells that look like this. These are usually would be the celebrated pairs that gives you very, very clear mark of something interesting going on. So this would be the firing of cell B with respect to the firing of cell A. So if cell A spikes at time zero, you ask, well, when does cell B tend to fire with respect to cell A? And you find these very nicely correlated peaks. And you can, for this is for the retina, you can zoom. This is the scale. It's going to be something on the order of 20 milliseconds. But if you look over many, many pairs, and this is just one example, you look at, you find that the distribution of correlation coefficients is actually mostly sits very close to zero. And so while this pair over here is one of the small bumps here or somewhere, most of the pairs show relatively low correlation. And that's true, of course, not only in the retina. You see this in many other systems, cortical ones as well. And so the typical correlations, or even cells of a similar type, is relatively weak. I mean, normally, if I told you that I found a correlation between two things which was 5 or 10% correlation, you would say, well, look, go look for something which is actually is correlated and therefore interesting. But most of my point today is going to be about the fact that it's true that these are relatively weak pairwise correlations. But first of all, they are statistically significant. And mainly, when you take many of them into account, then they actually matter in a different way. Yes, Mitya. No. So, of course, this depends to some extent on the kind of stimulus that you showed. And this is over recorded from relatively, you know, very dense population. You get similar behaviors from natural movies to artificial stimuli or strong full-field flicker ones, which will drive the correlation to be a little bit higher, but you're not going to shift it by a lot.
What you're saying, though, is that space.
Yeah, and I'm going to tell you a lot about space in a little while. The final frontier. Sorry? This is the look. So if you look at the, well, the instantaneous firing rate. Well, you can do this in bins, or you can do this in firing rates. It basically gives you very similar answers. Yes. Well, these have on and off cells, so this will be probably part of the reason why they look this way. But yeah, there's no clear tail on the negative side. Yes. Yeah, so it's not a lot of that. So this is was done in 20 millisecond bin size. Andreas's data is, you know, as Ron says, it's much wider bins. So I don't expect, no, I don't expect them. I'm just. It won't immediately scale because there is an issue about, I mean, where you really work with small, you know, numbers, or, you know, the fact that you can have many spikes in a bin actually gives you a different range. But that's not really, I mean, the actual shape of the distribution is not something we spend a lot of time thinking about, actually. I mean, the main thing I want you to take from this, at least for now, and this is also similar in Andreas' data, is that the typical correlations are relatively weak, and they're not very high values typically. Peter.
What was the stimulus?
This is a natural stimulus?
So this is for a basic signal modifier.
Yeah, sure.
So that's the word. The basic signal modifier. So it's time dependent, right? So there are on cells that are going to be reported, right? Even if they're independent from the signal, you're going to be playing. The things like on-off cells,
Anyhow, the main thing is that the correlations are weak. We can spend a lot of time about the actual wave distribution and what they look like. And if you want to talk about signal and noise correlations, then Peter and I would be happy to take you for a spin over this. I think David had a question.
No, I think
it was censored. Okay. So the question of what these correlation structures actually mean for the kind of code that you might expect for a level population is kind of a very old argument, as you all know. And there are many buzzwords in terms of what the code should be and how things should be organized. So kind of some notions that you want to get cells to be that they're, you know, maybe they're very close to being independent from one another. You want them to actually do something active to get to the point where they kind of reduce the redundancy in the stimulus. You want them to do decorrelations. There's talk about synergistic patterns that carry much more information than what you get from each of the neurons. And so the notion of what is the nature of the code, there's a lot to do with what kind of dependencies or architecture of interactions you actually have between the cells, and which kind of implies how do the cells actually affect or relate to one another in terms of shaping what's the capacity of the code, or how rich is the vocabulary with which they can actually represent the world versus how much they can correct to the fact that they're intrinsically noisy. So there's one way you can actually quantify the relation between pairs of cells is to look at the responses of the two neurons to the same stimulus and look at their joint activity patterns and ask, well, how much information do I get about the stimulus from the joint words of cell A and cell B, and compare it to how much you get from each of the cells by itself if you were just to add up the information that you get from each of them. And so if you look at the difference between the two, then if this thing was negative, then you'll think it would be redundant. If they be positive, which means that the pair, they carry more information than the sum of each of the neurons, you'll be synergistic. And if it's close to zero, then you kind of say, well, the cells are kind of independent in terms of how much information they actually carry. So when you actually do this, this is, again, retinal data from Michael's lab. This is looking at the redundancy and normalizing it such that it goes between -1 and 1. So 1 here would be perfect redundancy. The cells are identical. And -1 would be perfect synergy. You just carry information as a pair that you can't see from each of them on its own. And this is, every dot here is one pair of cells. These are many different kinds of natural movies, and their name tells you something about the kind of movement that you had in the movie. And what you basically see is that while you can find pairs which have high redundancy values, most of the pairs are actually weakly redundant. That's kind of the average value among them. And the typical number would be that you find, again, cells that in terms of their fractional redundancy, how much information they share in terms of how of sending information to the brain is on the order of 5 to 10%. This is normalized between to 1, yeah. So this is how much of the information that is carried by one cell is also carried by the other cell. Steve? Sorry? Yes, So this is looking at the joint response of many cells to several different natural movies. Every dot here is one pair of cells. You look at the joint responses and you ask, if I look at the distribution of the words that I get from the pair and kind of try and read out what was the stimulus, do you gain or by looking at the pair compared to what you know from each of them, and how much do they actually overlap in terms of carrying one another? No, I didn't plan to, so we can. The synergy. It's very nice. Uh, So mostly this is something that we see from different cell types. We've actually done a lot of work on even looking at what happens at the spikes within a given cell and kind of look at combinations of spiking and silence versus joint spiking and ask, you know, what are the cases where you can think of the different combinations of, you know, different compound symbols you can have in the system. So to a large extent, the synergistic things here are things which came from different functional types, but that's the extent I can actually comment on this right now.
Is this also an experimental goal test?
Yes. So it doesn't go flat. We've done this with fine checkerboards. You can also do a lot of tests when you actually try to you take what you think are separated cells and actually mix their spikes together and see how this would look like. And this, I mean, this is, I show you here, you know, stuff that come from natural movies. We have similar things going on for, if you look at spatial temporal white noise, so there's very short scale on which you actually get, and you see things kind of focusing more on this part here, and then here things will become more and more independent, and you get very reliable numbers there. So these are real, but again, what I want to emphasize is that it's not so much about the numbers here. It's more about the fact that most of the points are somewhere around here that I think are the main story here. So you're asking if the same pair will have a similar redundancy value for different kind of stimuli? Seven. So the nature of redundancy between cells is depends on the stimulus quite a bit. So there is correlation. I mean, if you look at the values of the two cells under different stimuli, they are correlated, but there's a real issue of what are the receptive field properties of these particular cells and what was going on in the movie. So it's not like there's a canonical number for each pair that you can go with for a different stimuli. You want to try the other thing you were? Richard?
Can you give us an example of two cells that have a redundancy of -1?
So, the extreme case where you have perfect synergy, actually, I'll have an example later, so just hold on to it. So, this is a common result in many other people who have done this in different systems. This is mostly showing here cortical data, but it's done in other systems as well. So this is from Danny Reich in Jonathan Victor's group that looked at redundancy among pairs, triplets, and larger groups, and found, again, weak redundancy between these groups. This is Gal Chechik's work with Ellen Elkin on the auditory cortex, and again, going up from the IC up to cortex, you find numbers which are on the order of, you know, normalized redundancy on the order of, again, 10%. This is the first one, the paper that actually do this. This is Gahn and Richmond in the visual cortex back in the early 90s, and they also look at, so this here, one would be in their unit would be independent, this would be redundant, this would be synergistic, so most of the cells sit around, you know, 10 or 15% redundancy. So this is kind of the typical thing, okay? So regardless of whether you want to think about the correlation functions or you want to think about, you know, synergy or redundancy as a measure of the dependency between pairs, or if you, there's been a lot of controversy about how you should actually measure the dependency between cells, it doesn't really matter which one of them is used. The typical number for pairs is relatively small. And so you might think, well, maybe this just means that I don't need to worry all that much when I'm trying to figure out what the code is all about, because if the typical redundancy or correlation or dependency in other way you want to measure it is small, then maybe I can just get away with thinking about the cells as being independent of one another because the differences are relatively small. So if you look at those responses of many cells and you discretize time, and now you're going to look at some part of the response, and this will be a binary pattern that will describe what these 10 cells were doing in every time slot along the movie. You can ask, well, maybe instead of trying to figure out what is the nature of the joint activity pattern of the population, you can really do a very good job with looking at the product of what the cells were doing on their own. And it turns out, and this, of course, would be very nice, because then all you need to know is about the firing rate of each of the cells in this different bins. And this will mean that instead of the general case where you need an exponential number of parameters to describe the dependencies between n elements in a network, you can get away with just n of them. Fred? Yeah, so this depends critically on what you call statistically independent. So so if this is the one that you use, then of course with this you can get higher value of redundancy. That's true, but that's a completely different talk, which I'm happy to. So there are different. Peter, you want to come help me with this? So there are three ways in which you can think about the relation between two cells and trying to define the dependency between them. So we can do an afternoon thing about this if you want, but I'll give you just a short version now. There's one which says, well, one version is what Fred just called statistical independence, so you can think of this as kind of the total kind of relation which is not specific to any kind of stimuli that you showed to, and you ask, how does the joint activity relate to the pattern of activity you get from the product, kind of summed over all different stimuli and all different cases that you look at. You can have independence where you condition on the stimulus and you actually look at whether the joint activity for specific stimuli factorizes, condition on that value of the stimulus. And it turns out that the two measures actually are related to one another, and the difference between measures of these two ways of looking at things is actually the redundancy and synergy between things. So you can actually show that if you ask, so if you have a stimulus and you have two neurons responding to it, then the synergy between x1 and x2 with respect to the stimulus S, but let's just call it like this, is going to be the difference between the information between the cells given the stimulus and the mutual information between the cell activities when you kind of, this is average of all the values of the stimulus. So just one more thing. So this is a measure of you can think of this as a measure of the noise correlations between cells, which is an extremely bad name, but this is the common name, so we'll stick with it. But this is kind of describes the joint variability of the cells when you repeat things many, many times. This is the dependency between cells, kind of what you see kind of average over all different things. So this is what, if you kind of observe the system and you don't know what the stimulus is, which is, by the way, what the rest of the brain does when it looks at the cells, this is the dependency you see between them. And the difference between these two is actually kind of gives you the synergy between the cells, which, for example, tells you that if you have no noise correlations, then this thing will be negative, so you'll just have redundancy. And if you have very strong noise correlations, that's the only case where you actually, or when this thing is going to be larger than this, this is when you can get synergistic coding. And I still will reach the example of that in a bit. Okay. So you can have different ways in which this can cancel out, and yeah. So I'm happy to talk about this, and actually have slides somewhere else. So if you want to set an afternoon thing about this, I think maybe that's a worthwhile effort. But I'm going to focus now, or at least for the rest of the next 20 minutes or so, about just the notion of what does the joint activity patterns look like without taking into consideration specific stimulus values. So this is the point of view of whoever listens, in this case to the retina, or one neural circuit needs to know another pseudo neural circuit. You don't know what the stimulus is. All you see is this joint activity patterns. What does it seem like in terms of their dependencies? Okay? So, and the reason why this would be cool, of course, is that this would allow neurons to be have a very high capacity to encode information. This is, the idea goes back to Atnyak and Barlow in terms of having efficient coding by having every neuron do a different thing and have them to be decoupled from one another. So if you look at the large population of cells and ask, well, does it really hold that if you look at the pairs and it seems weakly correlated and weakly redundant, does it really, when you look at a large population, how correlated are they? And the answer is they're very strongly correlated. So this is, in blue, you actually see the actual data. So this is looking on 100 ganglion cells, again, responding to a natural movie. This is in 20 millisecond bins. It doesn't really matter what size bin you take. And we just count here, for every bin, how many of the 100 cells were spiking. So this is the kind of distribution of synchrony values. And in blue, you see the actual data. Red is what you would get from the given the firing rate of the cells if things were actually independent, which tells you you would never, ever see more than 20-something cells spiking together if the cells were independent. All the stuff about these joint spiking or synchronous patterns that you see in this case is the result of correlation going on in the system. Shmini. Yes. Yes, it doesn't. It could give you this. You'll have to wait for 20 slides or so. But for now, I'm focusing on looking at what is being driven by the stimulus is something you can do when you do an experiment and you know what the value of the stimulus is and figure out how things behave. For now, I'm going to focus on how does the system look like from outside when you don't know what the stimulus is? What is the nature of the joint activity patterns? Because reading the code in this way is what the rest of the brain actually needs to do. Can we, this is going to show up later, okay? Yes. Yeah, so I chop up time into, in this case, 20 millisecond bins, and I count for every, so now disregard the identity of which neuron spiked, and I just, how many spiked in a given moment?
This is MEA recording.
This is MEA recording, yes.
So could it be all the spikes in one cell?
Theoretically, yes, in practice, and when the resolution that we work here, basically, almost in all cases, cells either spike or don't spike, so this is small enough bins that you rarely get more than one neuron spiking in a bin. So this is a good approximation for how many of the cells were actually spiking.
And so you don't disregard any
distance? Yeah, for now I'm disregarding this. I'll talk about distance a lot in a minute. So this is kind of an array that is kind of spans a little over 1.5 millimeters. So they kind of come in different places.
So just understand,
yes.
Cells in
yes. So this is very rare. You know, this is something you get once in a 3-hour-long experiment. Okay, this is not a common thing, but you have a very clear tail here, where these things happen often enough that they're very different than what happens if things were independent. Sorry? A little over 100 in this case. I don't know the cells that don't fire.
You can't take into account. So when you're just picking up spikes, but you can't say for sure that they rely heavily on the spikes.
Yeah. Yeah,
I'm a very low spike cell. You've got next to the sorting, you actually have two cells in one.
Yeah, we've done a lot of tests and we've looked at, you know, very dense arrays where we can very extremely happy with the sorting. This is not an issue. I don't think this has anything. I mean, the tail here is very robust and we also see it in other places. So I don't think this is even if you actually were to look at cells which are relatively far apart, then so you're pretty sure that this is not about sorting. You still get the same tail. That basically the main point here is that the population as a whole is much more correlated than you would expect if things were independent. Okay.
It's a string question, right?
Yes.
The firing rates of neurons just go together along the signals you would get.
No, but so I have the slides, but it's 20 slides down, so we can talk about how the stimulus actually affects these things. But I think this is a very important question, but it has much more of an experimental flavor to it than what the brain actually needs to do, which is to focus on how does the joint activity dependence look like when you don't know what the stimulus is. So bear with me for a while. I'm going to talk about how does the joint activity look like, and then we can talk a lot about how the stimulus affects things. So maybe you might not ask it. I don't know. So, yes. So because this tells you that, oh, Mitchell is coming to the front.
Ah.
Oh, I thought you wanted to pay attention. So I think that so Robert is making the point I was trying to make before all the questions about what the nature of this thing is that this basically tells you that the network is strongly correlated, because you get, you know, patterns of spiking of the joint of the population which are very, very far from what you would get just from if things were independent. And things become very much more clear when you look at specific groups of cells. So this is an example for 10 cells. Every dot in this plot here is going to be one activity pattern of the 10 cells. So it's 1,024 patterns. So now we keep the identity of each of the cells. So this will be kind of three examples of the patterns. This is the case where no neuron spike. This will be the first, third, fourth, seventh, and ninth, and so forth. And so here we, on this x-axis, is the actual rate with which you see this pattern in a two-hour-long experiment. And this is what you would predict would happen if things were independent. And this line is the equality line. And this will be, you know, many different orders of magnitude. It's a logarithmic scale. And my favorite, of course, is this pattern here that occurs once a minute in the experiment. And if things were independent, would occur once every 3 years. Okay. So this is how big of a discrepancy you get. Because although the pairwise correlations are weak, the network as a whole is very strongly correlated. And this is why you get patterns which have very, very different orders of magnitude rate of appearance compared to what you expect if things were independent. Yes. Yeah, but it's the same when you do it with sliding or not sliding. It doesn't really matter. We have enough data to do both. Yes. Yeah. Clear that when you look at the joint activity patterns and you don't, and you take the overall activity on some time window without keeping track of what was the actual value of the stimulus, the independent approximation is a very bad one. The network is strongly correlated. The pairwise stuff seems to be very weak. And so you might think, well, maybe this means that there's higher order stuff going on, which really dominates the way the network works. So what we would really need to do is to be able to kind of take the population and kind of disassemble the activity patterns and figure out what are the pairwise dependency, triple Y, quadruplet, and so forth. So kind of answering Richard's question a bit late, when you ask, well, what are these high order correlations that you might expect to find? So this will be the canonical example for three neurons. So if you have three elements and you see this four patterns appearing with equal probability, then it's clear that there is some structure here, because the other four patterns don't appear at all. But if you just look at pairs of cells here, so that's X1 and X2, you see that each of the four possible patterns appear with equal probability. So if you were just to look at the pairs, it would seem to you that there's no structure whatsoever between the cells. Only when you look at the whole group, you see higher order things going on. So this would also be kind of an example where you get synergistic coding is where, you know, these two cells actually, if this one of these would be, think of this as the stimulus, then these would be patterns which will encode things synergistically. You need to actually know what they're doing as a group. So how do you actually figure out what is the what is the nature of the strong correlations in the network. So to try and pick out what is the things that come from the pairwise stuff and what comes from higher order things, you can actually construct the minimal model given some things you want to build into the model. So this is where maximum entropy principle becomes very useful. So just to remind you, if the entropy of a distribution measures how much you don't know about it or how wide the distribution is, then if you want to build a model for your system and it's a probabilistic model, then among all the models that satisfy the thing you care about, you probably want to pick the one which is makes the least set of assumptions. And in terms of entropy, this would mean that you want the one that has highest entropy, which is the flattest distribution given some constraints that you put into your system. So if you have some things you want to retain in your model, so you've measured some functions of the data, this will be some observables of the system. We can talk about firing rate, correlations, and so forth in a minute. This is the thing you actually observed. You want to build a model P that will have the same values as what you see in the experiment. And among all the models that satisfy this, you want to have one that have the maximal value of the entropy, which basically comes down to saying, well, you want to, this is just what you need to solve. You need to maximize the entropy with these two Lagrange multiplier terms. One will be one for every one of the observables that you care about in the system. So we have one parameter here, and this is just the normalized distribution. And so if you actually maximize, then this will actually make sure that you satisfy these constraints, and you'll find the maximum entropy one. And this is kind of an old result that if you actually solve this, which you can do only numerically, but we know what the functional form is, that you will get an exponential distribution. So for each of the things you care about, the constraints or the functions that you cared about in the model, you will end up having an exponential model with one parameter for each of these things. And so for the case of just saying, well, let's build a minimum model that has the firing rate and the correlation function that we measure in the experiment at the level of the pairs, then this would mean to maximize the entropy where you satisfy the firing rate of each of the cells and the pairwise pair spiking of each of the cells. And the answer in this case would be an exponential model of the following form, which will have one parameter for each neuron and one parameter for each of the pairs. And x in this case will be just 1 and 0 if you use the common notation. Okay? And z is just a normalization factor or the physics version, that partition function. So if we actually go and build a model just from the firing rate and the correlation function and build this maximum entropy model, what we find is that although the typical pairwise correlations are very, very weak, they're enough to give a very good model of the system. So this is plotting again the data from before for the 10 cells. This is how the activity pattern, so every dot here again is one specific activity pattern. And the blue dots were the things from the independent model from before. And the red dots is how well the pairwise based model predicts the actual firing patterns in an hour-long experiment, average over all the values of the stimulus. This is how good of a fit we get. And if you're worried about the scatter of the points here, you shouldn't be, because there's an actual error bar on when the value is over here when you look at the observed rate of this actual pattern. So basically, you get this very, very close to being a perfect match. Yes? How I take into account? So I'm not just mapping the joint activity patterns for given instances of it. I don't look at the temporal patterns at the moment. So this is just asking about simultaneous activity patterns. I'll talk about the temporal ones later, I think. So here, this is 10 cells. There are 55 parameters in terms of fitting the model. There's 45 pairs and 10 parameters for each of the neurons. Richard?
What you say is an excellent model because it's something you base on a log of probability.
So the thing is that what I haven't... So first of all, it's much better than the independent model. OK, that's not a no-brainer. And are you worried about the fact that deviations around here? That's what you're asking, basically.
Sorry.
So this is what the model predicts. This is the actual data. This line here would be equality. So basically, all the red dots fall on the line. And if I actually were to plot some significant values in terms of our actually estimation of the data is the x-axis, y is the prediction of the model, okay? So Blue is the prediction of the independent model, and red basically is the prediction of the pairwise model. And to better quantify this exact thing of how good of a fit this is, what you can actually do is take the measure the total correlation in the network, which one should try and avoid the common extensions of usual correlation functions because they're very tricky for you to go from order two elements. But you can use an extension of the mutual information populations, and this would be something called the multi-information, which tells you how correlated the network is as a whole, which is the difference between the entropy of the product of the cells and the actual data. And so you can actually build yourself a hierarchy of models, which is based only on the different orders. So you can basically build the model just based on the firing rate, on the pairwise correlations, triplets, and so forth, and ask how much of the total correlation in the network, which is a measure of the difference between this one and this one, you actually capture with a pairwise-based model. So you can actually quantify the contributions of each of the orders by the difference of these two terms. And so what we find when we do this for many, many groups, this is for groups of 10 cells, on the x-axis, every dot here is one group of cells. This is how correlated is the group as a whole. This is how much of the total correlation of the network you actually capture with the pairwise-based model. And for most of the average number is around, it's a little over 90% of the total correlations you actually capture with the pairwise stuff. So there is a small contribution of higher order things, but by large, the pairwise model captures almost all the correlation structure in this network. So the x-axis is the value of the correlation of the network. So this is a measure of how correlated it is. So strongly, as the more correlated the network is, the more we actually get captured with the pairwise stuff. Each of these is a different network in a different experiment. Yes. Yeah. So actually, some of the notes here actually come from the different groups from the same experiment, but it doesn't really matter all that much. Yes. So you improve by a little bit. You don't have much to go beyond. So if pairwise gives you here about 90%, then the triple order will give you something like 3% more. This is roughly what you. Yeah, but you know this is. Almost, you get most of this with the pairs. To get really to one, you need there is some higher order stuff. Yes?
Is it possible that this term you actually do better than that because it's just weird that most information drops, the number drops. You can just from random fluctuations do that.
Yeah. Yeah, we might be actually doing better, but can we take this offline at this? Yes. Okay. So just one more thing. So this is just to summarize this. This is for many different retinas, different kind of stimuli. So again, this is an average measure over many groups of how much of the network correlated activity we capture with the pairwise-based model. And again, the numbers for different kind of natural movies and Fufu Flicker. And this is the guinea pig, which now has even worse issues than before. Sorry? Sorry, what do you mean the very small number of? I mean, I need to fit the whole distribution. I need.
I mean, you're using log plot all the time. So we have deviation from the large amount of data, it's very small.
No, because the thing is that when you look at the patterns over here, which is the very common patterns in which one neuron was firing and the other nine were silent, the independent model already missed those by an order of magnitude. So it's not like I just need to fit things at the tail. You actually miss even things which are very, very common with an independent model. Okay?
No.
Okay. No, but the main point is that there's a quadratic number of pairs. So what I've done with the maximum entropy model is to build a model that takes into account all knows how to combine the contributions of all the pairs together. And so by the time you've no, but you mean they're weakly correlated? That's exactly the point. If they were not correlated, then I wouldn't need to do anything, right? Then we can all go out and have coffee. But this is really because there are weak pairwise correlations, and when you actually start to assemble them together one by one, it actually has a macroscopic effect that even shows you that even the very common patterns of one neuron spiking and all the other being sunny, even these ones you would miss if you didn't take these correlations into account. You don't seem happy. You come from the right country for belief issues. Yes?
So if I use the same analysis, for the example, with three neurons that you gave,
yes,
then I would get, if I just took into account two neuron correlations, I would explain nothing.
Nothing, yes. Exactly. Sarah? Back or forward?
Forward.
Sorry. Sorry.
Yes.
Yes.
So, where does cortical data come from? And if I actually, just give me a clue for how many spikes do I need if I wanted to do this on V1 data or M1?
I'll show you V1 data in a minute. So this is actually cortical culture. That's a kind of a misleading cartoon.
Let's say I want to do this for movement electrode recording.
Yes.
How many spikes per neuron do I need to?
So that's, you don't need a lot of spikes. So the thing is that unlike many other, so when you're trying to fit a model for the large population of cells, there's always the caveat of saying, well, I'm having a hard time sampling these joint patterns. The thing here is that what we use to actually build the model is just the correlation functions between the cells. And that's something which is very, and the firing rate, which is something you can estimate extremely reliably. So in fact, when we, sorry? No, to get IN, I actually need to sample the full distribution of the system. But I'm asking can I build a decent pairwise model? And the answer is I can do this very, very easily. And in fact, I'm going to show you in a minute that it's actually, the pairwise model will be going to be even better than direct sampling in many, many cases. But if you, so kind of as a kind of a, to get just to give you a short answer, I need a few minutes of joint recording to actually get a very good pairwise model, 5 minutes or so. To compute the ratio is that then you need to actually have to be able to sample the true distribution very reliably, and this requires a very large number. But so this really, for this, this is when you actually want to prove that there's nothing else that you're missing or how much there is that you're missing.
Yeah, I would like to know.
But this means that you actually have.
Okay, so now when M1 is doing its thing, not sitting in a culture, I would like to know the ratio I2 over
IN. So I think.
In
computing IN, it requires actually mapping the joint, the true joint distribution, which I'm going to dare say that I think you can actually do for more than 10 cells, even in a very long experiment. I mean, this is roughly where the boundary of actually sample distribution. The thing is that you can look at how good of a model you get from the pairwise model, and you see that in many cases you can actually distinguish between that one and the data. I'll show you that in a minute. Yes. It's big. Sorry. I had to go with the joke. So it could be that the very small thing that you have here has very important meaning, right? And let's just keep on, hold on to that. I'll, yes. Yes. So, so what I'm telling you is that I can capture almost all the structure with the pairwise stuff. When in principle you didn't know which one you need. So now you say, look, I'm not happy with 90%. I want the rest. Tell me which of the I order how can I get them, and what do they actually mean? And I say, fine, but I'm still going to be at least for now very happy with the fact that I guess most of the structure with the pairs, and And I'm going to show you in a minute, I hope, or a few minutes, that actually it's maybe we're not that far from this than we think for larger networks. So, but, so you can't really reject that for, I mean, there is some contributions of the higher order, but this is on the point where it's very, very slippery if this is real, how big of a thing this is or not. Yes?
So I still don't completely understand how surprised I should be with the finding that
very
correlations account for the majority of word frequencies. So if I said, for example, you know, I came up with some model that would, you know, some out of all sets of models, I would come up with some model, then what are the chances that in this model, two-point correlations would not explain?
So I think that most people, if you told them that the typical correlation that you find in the system between pairs is on the order of 5%, then the fact that when, by the time you've collected these weak correlations, you actually have such a large effect of the network, that would be surprising. So that's my main point. Yes? 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 If I manage to go beyond the slides, I may actually be able to tell you some of the really interesting stuff. Yes?
Yeah, I have an experimental story. This is all done in a video or something like that.
Yes.
Right? And what is this spiking, what is the excitability in the dark?
In the dark?
In the dark, and it's so quiet.
No, so what happens in the dark for the retina is that if you wait for about half an hour, then the cells start firing because they elevate their firing rate because they know that.
And if you take this preparation as you you change the correlations by boosting the preparation to the amount of the extracellular fluid and do something that makes the cells a little bit more excited and can reveal in that way what's the real structure.
I wonder what would not necessarily know what it means by the real one, but we haven't done that experiment, but actually we looked at different stimuli, so I think this will actually answer part of this.
What was the alpha rate for us?
On the order of 3 spikes per second. This is it. So just to show an example for cortical data, this is multi-unit data from Joseph Fisher and Mike Walicki from a few years back when this is ferrets watching a different kind of movies. So this is 16 electrodes, multi-unit data in 2 millisecond bins. And this is just to show you that it kind of have a similar behavior. So again, this is what you would predict from independent cells. This is what the model predicts. The blue is the predictions from the independent models. And this is how good of a fit you get from the pairwise one. And again, these are basically fall very close within the, you know, the kind of confidence interval of what you would actually expect to get from this kind of pattern. And if you now ask, you know, again, how much of the correlation you actually capture with the pairwise model, then here again you sit on the order of very much even closer to 100%. So I don't know if you can reject the higher order ones or not. So you can actually go and kind of now ask, well, now that you've built the model, what is the nature of the dependencies between the cells? What is the underlying network that actually creates this joint activity? And so if you switch from a 1 to 0 representation to 1 minus 1, then the sigmas here change into S's for some reason. This all should be sigmas, of course. So this will be the physics version, which would just the Ising model. And so you can think of this thing as being the energy of the configuration of the system. And so what we've built in terms of parameters for single neurons or pairwise relations between the cells, you can think of as the bias of every neuron to spiking as kind of the local field that operates on this neuron, and the coupling between cells in this model is kind of something that comes from the exchange interaction in the physics version of things. And so if you look at the example for 10 cells, this is a typical kind of an example of the interaction matrix between cells, which has no clear structure. There's more positive interaction terms than negative ones, so cell would like to be either spiking together or silent together more than they would be to do the opposite thing. But you know, one of the cells here is an on cell, the rest are off cells. It's hard to say which is even in this case. And if you, yes?
Sorry, the noise is buried in J, H?
Sorry, the noise? So there's no explicit temperature here at the moment. This is just working in kind of units of one if this wasn't the Ising model. Okay? Yes. 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 So, yes. So actually, when we solve the model, this is sorry. Of course, it is. It's a maximum entropy problem. So there's a unique solution which we can get, and this is how this looks like. And when we look at the distribution of values, we find that, again, the typical interaction is positive. So cells would like to be doing things together, either silent or active. And the local field or the bias of the cells is towards being silent most of the time. And what's critical about inferring these interactions on the values of interaction in this model is that they're very different than what you would normally think about the correlations between the cells. So, of course, if you had three cells and you look at, you know, one cell was actually driving two other cells, you might get a correlation between A and B which will be very strong. But this will be coming from a different cell that's driving them together.
But you think that was instantaneous, right?
Yes.
So what does it mean?
So this is kind of driven in, well, you look at 20 millisecond bins. So this is kind of the how they affect one another in that time window. So this is kind of just to argue that what you would look at as the correlation between cells is something that can be masking the actual dependencies between cells. So when you compute, just a second, when you compute the correlations between elements, you average over what everybody else in the network is doing. And what we've done here is when we build the model which satisfies all the correlations at the same time, I basically get a purified version of the dependencies between cells. So what you would consider as the correlation, again, on that time bin, I'm not looking at temporal things at the moment, what you would find is you can get pairs which will be strongly correlated because there is a third cell that actually, if you actually, when you actually look at the model that you get from the maximum entropy construction, is that there is another cell that actually has a strong interaction with both of them, but they're actually not coupled at all to one another. And then you can find pairs of cells which will, the correlations will seem to be very weak, but that's because there's a complicated structure of interactions going on between them, which is what I'm going to try and. I'm not sure. I mean.
Well, if you assume that you can.
Yeah. So I can do a temporal version. It doesn't really matter. So just. I could introduce time dependence, and if time permits, I'll introduce them.
First of all, this is an interpretation that you're putting in the model. The point is that interaction is not the same as the correlation.
So the point is that the interaction map that you get is very different from the correlation map. And it actually is because when you build your Ising version of the problem, you actually satisfy all things at the same time. This forces you to kind of clean out the cases where you would overcount correlations between things. Because if I talk to you, you to David, David talks to me, I don't want to count each of these correlations as, you know, being a real thing in the system. Now, David was very unhappy about something. So we've done everything in terms of building the model here with a fixed temperature, which is 1. I just declared the temperature to be 1, and I measure everything. We've done this also when we actually change the temperature. So I can look at the dependency of what is the actual, if you want to think about the intrinsic noise values of the system. But
how does the noise measure, which is sort of a
So you can just kind of, for this, you can just ask me, you know, if I were to look at the distribution, this is kind of gives you a sense of the distribution of the patterns that you get, right?
J has built in with the rate of the cell?
No, this is... No.
The variance goes
to
the variance of the variance of...
Well,
the cells, I mean, the correlations are, like, they don't necessarily, the correlations are small.
Yes.
So the variance of the rate would follow
us.
The rate
yeah, but the thing is that the correlation and the interactions are very, I mean, when their correlations are very big, then the interaction is also very big, but there's a very intricate structure in terms of how the interaction actually look very different from the correlations themselves. So in terms of that intuition, I'm not sure you...
Suppose I double the rate of all the cells.
Yes.
That would be where they would give something to the rest.
So this would be... So the question is now, would I only need to do is to change the age parameter that controls the intrinsic properties of each of the neurons, or do I need to actually change the way they talk to everybody else?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we haven't done that experiment, but I'm going to show you what happens for different stimuli and how this actually changes. I hope. So in fact, if you go and look at larger and larger networks, so you're going from two neurons to many neurons, you can look at the relation, what you find in this model, and ask, well, what is the contribution of the single cell property, which is kind of related to what David just asked, and what comes from the rest of the population? So you can actually kind of summarize the local field or the effect of the population on this side, and what is kind of the intrinsic value or the parameters for each of the neurons. And this is average over many, many cells. So you see that as you go for larger and larger networks, it seems like the contribution of the populations becomes larger in terms of determining of kind of the effect on a neuron than its own intrinsic properties.
I have a dumb question. If you go back one, okay, if you have JIJ mm-hmm. Is going to be the basically the synaptic weights.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is a kind of a symmetric interaction measure, right? So this has not come to stand in the kind of replace a real synaptic connection. If you had a third order one, which I'll talk about hopefully soon, then this would actually mean that there is dependency. So something in terms of how things are wired creates a triple synchrony that you can't explain from any of the pair relations. Now, so you'd remember that this is all looking at ganglion cells, so most of the wiring and what makes them do things together actually comes from the amacrine cells and bipolar cells that we don't see here. This is not, I mean, I don't know what the actual wiring is, so I can't kind of compare the, these JIJ to the actual synaptic weights.
There it says that JIJ has to equal JJI.
No, this is how you build it with the Ising model. So this
with
is how
the
we
Ising
build it.
Model, yes. No, but I mean, but what you said before.
Yeah, well,
with, no, but just the fact you use all pairwise interactions.
So when we did all the pair, what we use is we use the synchronous correlation functions between cells. So this they are symmetric. If we do this, when we do this in a temporal version, when you actually look at one cell, and then you can get direction and you can get the things which stand for synaptic
but
things.
But I'm just trying to say, if you don't, I'm not worried about Ising model.
Yes. No, I would. I didn't.
You just take all the observed
yes.
weights, JIJ and JJI, and you use those, and then you make a model.
Yeah.
What would it mean to say? What would it mean? I'm not seeing what JIJK.
So I don't know what would be the biophysical implementation of that, but this could be done by another cell that kind of drives all of them.
But the other cell can't.
No, but it could be one of the cells, kind of one of the amacrine cells driving the other cells. Yeah. So if you have one thing that's driving all of this with a pairwise fashion, if you just look at this, it would seem to you that there's higher order thing going on between them.
Let me make a comment about this class of models, because it's important also for models that we discuss later on in terms of analyzing their models, that they more into account the unidirectionality and the time dependence. These are as if models. You are going from a small set of and what they're trying to do is extend the statistics of the value of these small set of neurons that they're recording from.
Sure.
These neurons are embedded in a much larger network that they're not monitoring. So it might be that there are connections from the larger network onto the very subject.
That would mean you would measure the right pairwise correlation.
Well, but imagine.
Pairwise weights, right?
Imagine that there is a neuron, just imagine, there is a neuron that is projecting very, driving very strongly between neurons in an almost coincident manner. So, because you're not observing that.
I understand that, sir, but I'm saying, if you, that would say, of course, if you don't measure some of the important pairs, then you're not going to get it right. But if you measure, if you sample all the pairs.
No, if you sample.
Then it's gotten to just pairwise interaction.
Right, but not, but you're trying to explain the activity. But you're trying to explain the activity of the network, which was a sample.
Yeah. Well, there's one which is even worse, which is what Srini asked before, and I tried to push aside for a minute. But there is one thing that you don't see here, which is the stimulus. And that, the stimulus. So the stimulus, not the simulus. So the stimulus is driving these cells in some way, and you don't, it's not part of the network that you observe. And so this may induce very complicated high order things. In fact, for natural movies, you would expect to have a lot of high order things going on, and it doesn't seem to be the case here, that it's enough here that you look only at the pairs and that captures what's going on. In terms of, I don't know what the biophysical implementation of a third body dependency would be. I mean, we can.
Nietzsche said it, not linear.
Yeah, yes, but.
Okay, anyway, though, sorry, I feel better about it. Go ahead.
Okay. So if we go for larger and larger network, and we ask, well, how do they look like? And if you look at the total entropy of the network or the actual measure of the correlation in the network with the function of the number of cells, what we see is that the network becomes more and more correlated as we take the network to be larger. And we kind of, this kind of would imply that the what we've seen already, the level of tensors become even more correlated for larger networks. So one implication, yes. Yeah, but when I get to larger networks, then I will. Okay. So, in terms of this, this is asking if you look at the same groups of cells within a given portion. So this is a kind of a dense group, and we sample different numbers of cells from that small group.
And so you're saying
as I increase the as you look at more and more cells, things would look that as if, I mean, things become more and more correlated as a network. Yeah, because there's dependencies between things, and the more cells you add, every cell you add has, you know, order of n dependencies among the things around it. So things become tighter and tighter.
I'm not sure. So let's say I have n neurons.
Yes.
K.
Now I'm making K bigger. Yes. For now, I haven't taken into account them.
So this prediction that you're making, how long would you trust?
I'm not going to get to that, but I can tell you about this later. But yeah, but it both actually, I mean, this is a different issue, right? Because there is a physical number of the neurons in that given patch, and actually looking more and more of the cells in that given patch. So I could ask, what if I were to take the whole retina, and that's a different issue. But okay. So if you try and look at what does it mean that the network would become more and more correlated, you can ask, well, how well can I predict what one neuron is doing from looking at its neighbors? And you can find that you get more and more knowledge. This is how much information you have from the population about this cell normalized by its own entropy as a function of the population. And you see this kind of growing steadily, at least for small networks. And it's kind of interesting to ask, well, what would happen for larger networks? So I'm going to skip this one. So this is kind of the stuff. So this was all old stuff. And this is the few minutes I have left. I want to tell you a little bit about the new stuff, which is actually going to larger networks. So this is what we see when we look at the groups of 100 cells which we record simultaneously. basically a similar answer in terms of the fact that the pairwise model is doing a much better job than the independent one. But now, of course, since these are 100-cell patterns, we can't sample the true distribution, so I can't really tell you how much of the high-order stuff I'm actually catching.
Is that down to the third order?
Sorry?
Is that down to the third order?
Yes, I'll tell you about this in a bit. This is what happens when we actually try and build temporal models of this network. So we actually take the correlation function as a function of time and start asking, you know, how well can, if we look at the temporal correlations, now we have directed errors in time, and we can ask, you know, how good of a fit do we get for this? And here, we start to see things slipping, and also we actually saw them a little bit here. Some of these patterns here are not on the line, and if you ask me about this later, I'd be happy to tell you that we actually see higher order contributions coming into play. And what, how they're implemented, Chuck asked, is a very interesting question, but there's a clear structure of, you know, dependency between the cells, which we cannot explain from just from pairwise relations between them. Okay? What's the question here? Both and both. So when we include time, both for, if you do the synchronous value for a large population, we start to see the need for higher order things, and then also for the temporal one. But you still capture a very large, you do a very good job with the pairwise model, but you start to see the contribution of higher order things showing up. Pairwise in space, independent. No, that makes a big difference. If you want to predict temporal patterns, that makes a big difference. Yes.
But, I mean, if I just count the degrees of freedom, right? If I have 100 neurons, I have 2 to the 100 words.
Yes.
But the number of pairs increases on the.
Yeah, that's the point of why this is a very, very useful thing to do, right? I mean, instead of 2 to the 100 parameters, there's 5,000 that you need to estimate, and I'm going to show you in a minute that you actually don't even need all of these. So in fact, when we go and ask, you know, how good of a model do we get with the pairwise model, I'm going to measure for the different network size how good of a model do you actually get from sampling. This is the thing that Sarah asked before. So I'm going to chop the experiment in two halves, and I'm going to ask how well do I predict one half from the other. This is going to be the black points over here. So this is going to be a distance. This is a normalized Kuhlbach-Leibler thing called the Jensen-Shannon divergence, which goes between 0 and 1. What this basically tells you in the black dots here is how well, what's the distance between one half of the experiment and the other half, and this in terms of prediction of the patterns. And this is not because of stationarity or anything. This is how well you predict, the distance of how well one half of the experiments predict the specific patterns of the other, just because there are very many of the patterns are relatively rare. So in fact, if you build a pairwise model of the first half of the experiment, it's a better predictor of the second half of the data. This 1 hour, train on 1 hour, you predict on what's going to happen to the other hour. The pairwise model is actually better than sampling the data for 1 hour in the experiment. So we actually do better with the model than the actual sampling of the data. This is how good of a model you get from the pairwise. And it's very hard to sample large, the joint activity of large population.
The other ones are like,
yes. Yeah, but here I actually use an hour of the data, and this is still not. So you would think that if you have 10 neurons and you sample them 20 millisecond bins, there are 150,000 patterns, and you sample 1,000 possible pattern space, and you still do better when you build a pairwise model. This is just to show you how good of a model this is. So now, so you actually, either you can do that or you can actually take a prior which has to do with the number of spikes in it. It doesn't really matter for the things here. So yeah, but can we discuss this later? So this is actually how the network looks like when you take the 100 cells. This is the, every dot here is one neuron on the array. The size of the dot tells you something about the firing rate of that neuron. Red links are positive interactions, blue ones are negative ones. And I'm plotting only the things that cross a certain threshold, so you can actually see the strong, relatively stronger interactions in the network, just a second. And so now we can look at this interaction map and try and say, well, how can we actually start to make sense of the, I don't want to say connectomics, but can we actually make sense of this network interaction that we find in this system? David? Well, it's interactomics. Sorry. Yes, no, this, the thing.
It's not uniform. It's the neuron, in a sense, that they're not sounding the neurons, because then that's what that body is doing.
Yes, but we've done this both for, I mean, this is a, we've looked at what happens in, for, I mean, in the middle, we get most of the cells, which is about 60. This is kind of looking also what happens in the larger things. It doesn't seem like anything special is going on in that sense. So it is going to bias you in terms of how you, of course, the kind of correlation, the interaction you infer, but I'll show you the data for the function of the distance in a minute. So I think this will kind of give you an answer. Yes. So the size of the node tells you something about the firing rate of that specific neuron. And these are the actual interaction terms, and this is the kind of the map of pairwise relations between the cells that explains what the 100 cells are doing. Sorry? This is the physical layout on the array. OK? So now we can ask, well, how does the interactions depend on the distance? We find that they decay with the, so this is a receptive field distance between the cells. This is how, I mean, so you get a relatively stronger things nearby, and then they decay. And if you were to reorder things in a certain way, you find that there's actually, you can think of the way things are organized, that there are like kind of local neighborhoods where the cells actually kind of talk to one another. These are kind of two different examples of different networks. You can still see this banding of structures. Well, this is a natural stimulus. So the things decay as one or a pair. So in this space, the size of receptive field is about 200 microns or so. So this is kind of. Yeah, we don't think so, and that's because we think it looks very, very stable when we took different parts of the data, so this seems to be extremely accurate. And in fact, what we find is that even if we take the pairwise model, we can actually throw a lot of the interactions out and kind of end up with a very, very sparse network that actually captures how the whole network works as a whole. So this is comparing to the full pairwise model, which I would argue is even a better model of the data than the data itself in terms of asking how well you do things. So we compare and we ask, you know, what happens if you start throwing interactions? How good of a model do you get? And so this is a function of the number of interactions that you actually have. 5,000 would be the if you had all pairwise interactions. If you throw them randomly, you have some decay. But this is what happens if you were to throw them either according to the receptive field between distance between the cells or the size of the correlations or the actual interaction term. You find that you can actually do a very good job with about, you know, a fifth of the interactions. You can pick them up different ways, and basically you get a model which is as good as you had when you had the full pairwise model. So in fact, this seems to be explainable very well with a relatively even sparser network than the pairwise. Yes? Yes. 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 So this is very stable. I can show you that this is very. I mean, we have enough data here to do this very reliably. Yes. So we can actually ask, you know, what is the typical distance between cells that you need to take into account? So you can kind of ask, you know, how well do I predict a neuron given its neighbors? So how many of the neighbors do I actually need are relatively strongly coupled to a cell? This is kind of average over many, many example. So this is kind of the decay. So around 20 cells, you kind of saturate the dependency among the neighbors. And this sets kind of the idea of trying to figure out how the network as a whole is organized in the case of the retina, at least, is that we can ask for every given neuron, I mean, in terms of its dependency on the rest, is it really that it really needs to talk or talks to everybody else? Or is there kind of a local neighborhood that really defines the architecture of the network here? So there's kind of neat idea that comes from graphical models. It's called a kind of defining the Markov blanket of such an element. And it says, well, the Markov blanket is a group of the neighbors of this of an element in a graph or a neuron in the network in this case, that if you knew what all the members of this blanket were doing, you don't need to know anything about the rest of the network. So this kind of isolated from the rest of the network. This would make this neuron independent from the rest of the network if you knew what all of its immediate neighbors were doing. So we can try and estimate this kind of, it's a hard computational problem, so we can try and estimate these kind of blankets, and what we find, this is kind of a toy example of what we did for 60 cells. You can try and estimate what is this blanket for different neurons. Every dot here is one cell. This is kind of an example of some of the blankets that we find. These are, I think, all off cells, if I remember correctly. And so what you find is that this blanket of which are the neurons in the rest of the network that you actually kind of talk with or depend on, that defines a local neighborhood which is on the order of, you know, a little over two receptive fields, and they're highly overlapping. So there's kind of these communities, if you want to think about how things are organized. Every neuron or every group is kind of organized as some kind of a relatively highly interactive thing that kind of have small patches which kind of cover one and another. Yes? Yes. Yes. So this could complicate things, and it turns out that you need to go to about 20 members, and that kind of sets the size of your blanket.
Why doesn't this layout look like the layout where you showed the strength of interaction?
Because this kind of defines how, this is actually, it's not the same network, but that's the main reason it's not that. So there's also percolation properties here, which I'm going to skip, and I'm going to skip this one as well. Still a few more minutes and kind of answer the thing about the. So we can actually go and look at the architecture, and kind of we can find the motifs or anti-motifs in this interaction maps, which I can tell you about later if you want. I want to just give you one more feeling for why we think things are organized this way, and this is kind of a work that just came out with Gaspard Kacik and Jason Prentice and Vijay Balasubramanian, where we ask, well, can we ask theoretically what we should expect to be going on? I mean, you could ask yourself for a second, well, why? I mean, okay, so you have a model that kind of explains that things depend on one another in a certain way. Why would they be dependent in such a way on one another at all? Can you actually kind of build a argument for which kind of network you actually want to try and build? So what we did was to ask kind of a completely theoretical question for a moment, and then I'm going to show you some data in a few minutes or not, is if I were to have a network that would depend, when I could actually have these dependencies in a certain way, what would be the optimal network that I would build to encode the stimulus that I was presented with? And this is going to depend on two things, of course. The kind of network that you're going to end up building is going to depend on, well, the kind of stimuli that you need to encode. And the thing that bothered David before, which is what is the level of the noise in the system? And that's kind of trying to argue what would be the optimal network that you're going to build. And so for a given set of stimuli, what we're going to do is we're going to build now the thing that Srini was worried about before. We're going to build a stimulus-dependent model of the system, which will kind of combine the old notion of using an LN model to describe what each of the neurons are doing, and then to build kind of the stimulus, this way to build the stimulus dependence for the cells, and ask what happens when you actually couple the cells together. So this kind of build now a maximum entropy model or an Ising model where every neuron is coupled to the rest in a way which is not determined by the stimulus, and there's going to be some local bias of each of the cells, and then there's going to be a term which is going to say how each neuron actually relates to the stimulus. And so we don't build explicit pairwise relations which are stimulus dependent. We assume that these are fixed. Okay, and we ask, well, what if you wanted to maximize the information that this network carries about the stimulus, what kind of networks would you build? And so kind of this is kind of the toy example for two neurons. You can ask, well, if I have two neurons and I have two inputs and I can control the covariance of these two inputs, what kind of link would I put between the neurons to maximize the information? And if these were binary inputs with some covariance, then as a function of the covariance of the inputs and the 1 over the temperature, so this can think of it, the reliability of the neuron, you'll see that you basically get kind of an averaging between the cells. So this is the sign of the coupling. So for strong, for positive correlations in the input, you have a positive interaction between the cells. For negative correlations, you have a negative interaction. But even for pairs of cells, if you have a Gaussian inputs which have some correlation between them, you're going to see a switch going from some averaging that's going to happen for relatively, so if you have low beta, which means that you have a high noise, then you're going to do averaging. So the size of the interaction is going to be the same as the size of the correlation in the input. But if you have low noise, then the optimal thing would be to do decorrelation between the cells. And so, of course, you can do this for larger networks. And what we find is we can actually see that for larger networks, you would and you can think of the old argument about whether you want to have a redundancy reduction code or independent code or synergistic code. This is just a continuum of solutions depending on the kind of correlation in the stimulus that you need to represent and the kind of noise that you have in the system, which can be depending on what the properties of the cells, but also what the rest of the brain is doing and sending to your network. So here's the kind of the summary of how this looks like. This is for a network where the neurons are decoupled, so you just can play with the tuning of each of the cells. And so depending on the net level of noise and in your system, what you're going to find is that if you go from high noise to low noise, then you can kind of try and play with how much entropy you get in the total activity of the cell and how much noise you get. And then you're going to get solutions in which you're going to get from the place where you basically try to encode as much as you can, but the noise basically kills you, to places where you have very little noise. Whereas if you're, just one thing, so if you actually couple the cells together, which is what we do here, what we find is that you will find solutions in which you have a very different behavior. So this will be, the stripes will be how much information you actually get. And you'll get that from a very different solution in which you're going to have lower output entropy, but also very low noise entropy. And you're going to live in this space where you actually almost keep the noise entropy very, very low. So this will be kind of the optimal architecture of these networks. Yes? So this is the different temperature, how noisy the system is, and the neurons are.
How do you put in the noise?
So the noise is, sorry. So now we take explicitly the temperature out of the send interactions, the local field. S is, there's a probability distribution of S. No, we look for, I mean, this is a the thing, you can manipulate this one as well. Yeah, well, you know, yeah, so the, this is, you use some, I mean, you can think of kind of a, this is basically an LN model where you try and say, well, I want to try and get this to be as informative as I can. So you use some kind of a, yeah, so we can
just.
So we, this is for a given set of stimuli value that we can do this for many different classes of stimuli. But what this is one case of Gaussian. So this the stimuli are given from a Gaussian distribution over for the 10 neurons with some covariance. And you ask, well, what kind of structure will I need to get high information about the system? And this actually gains you a lot of, you can actually get much more information from these, of course, correlated networks. And what happens is that you look at the nature of the interactions between the cells as a function of the correlations, and depending on the level of the noise, so this is going to be for high noise, you're going to do redundant decoding where the cells actually going to try and repeat one another, and so the size of the interaction is going to be similar to the kind of the correlation that you have in the average correlation that you have in the input. And if the temperature was low, which is you can see here, this would be the kind of interaction values that you find in that case. So the optimal network that you will get will depend, I mean, will be either decorrelating or averaging, depending on the kind of the world that you live in. And so I'm going to skip this and just give you one more point, which is this would mean that if, I mean, you can ask, why are the neurons coupled to one another to begin with? Right, on one hand, if you couple neurons together, then you limit the capacity of your system to encode information. Just because you couple them, they kind of influence one another. On the other hand, this is the only way you can fight the noise that you have in the system. So the optimal solution will be being somewhere in the middle between kind of finding a sweet spot that you optimize, kind of don't pay too much by losing the, in terms of the total entropy, and then kind of being able to correct for the noise. Yes. Yes.
Well, in that case, if you said by coupling that you limit the ability, you reduce the ability of the neuron to counter intuitive, which means that you have to think about other statements that you have to couple. There's a way to couple that you increase the decorrelation, and therefore you increase the ability.
Yeah, no, so the thing is, if you were free to pick your neuron to do anything you want, then I mean, but the fact that you couple them, you reduce the entropy of their whole system compared to what they would be that if everyone was doing its own thing, right? So,
so that's
kind of in terms of the richness of the vocabulary. You're saying, well, the fact that you know, the if I wanted to, if I given their properties and now I want to decorrelate them, then I would tune. I would need to have connection to do this. Sure, but in all cases you reduce the vocabulary of the potential vocabulary of your system. I mean, you're less rich in terms of the patterns you can get from your system. The question is, how do you use these patterns now to code for the different things in the stimulus?
Did I understand correctly that you didn't actually put noise in the stimulus?
No.
You put it in the neurons.
Yes, in the neurons. Yes.
Why?
Well, the noise and the stimulus would be something when we have a distribution of the values of the stimulus that you get. And I mean, I'm not sure what you mean by putting noise in the stimulus.
Well, because then I could understand why I wouldn't want to be on the different parts of that trajectory, right? If I'm in a noisy environment, then I want to do one thing. If I'm in
No, I assume you want to encode the stimuli, all the stimuli. I don't care. I mean, I don't know what the I mean, if
the neurons, the neurons have some level of noise, so
yes.
There would be only one point where they would want to sit.
No, so I pick the level of noise, and I pick the kind of correlation between them, and ask, well, now how should I tune the connections to be as informative as possible about the set of stimuli that you give me?
But why would those things change in the situation?
So the noise could change because the rest of the network is doing different things. The correlation and the stimuli change because you move to one world situation to another. Yeah. Well, it depends on what the other cells are in the neighborhood also doing. Yeah.
In the dark, I know that people
Yeah. Yeah. So, so.
You know, that was my question. The noise doesn't come from the limit, it comes from the neurons.
Yeah.
I'm going to push this aside for a minute because I want to make one more point and I'm already over my time. So if you ask yourself, what does it mean to wire things up to make an informative network, then what would this imply that the interaction between the cells will kind of create a prior on what the network would actually code. So if you think about the network and we have no, so you have a flat distribution of inputs for your system, for kind of some kind of distribution of input, and you don't couple the cells, and you have some prior over the different patterns that you get, and this will be kind of a uniform prior over all the possible patterns because you don't know what's actually going to see. And if you show a stimulus, something around here or here, there'll be the canonical pattern that you will respond with if there was no noise, but because there's noise, there's some distribution of patterns that you're actually going to get around it. which is actually going to make, of course, decoding much more complicated. But if you actually allow yourself to build the optimal network, you tune your network the right way, what will this imply is that even if you turn off the stimulus and you ask, well, what would the system look like if there was no stimulus, the model kind of gives you a prior on what would the, you can think of spontaneous activity that you might expect from the system. And this would actually echo the kind of dominant thing in the stimulus statistics that this optimal J would match to. So if you were to tune your network in a certain way to the stimulus, then if there is a high level of noise, this tuning would actually echo the kind of things that you're going to see in the outside world and you want to encode. And this is what we kind of get here. And so the cartoon idea is that if you have, depending on the level of noise that you live in, if you have low noise, then you can do decorrelation and be very happy with it and have the interaction such that they make the cells as independent as possible. But if you have noise, then what you expect to get is that there is going to be a prior on this kind of, you can think of as ground states of the system with which you actually encode what's going on. And so what we've tried to do is actually, so I'm going to skip a lot of this and just going to show you one example, is that we show now the retina different kinds of movies and we build this stimulus-dependent maximum entropy model and we ask, how does the interaction matrix look like for different stimuli? And so here's just, one example. This is the interaction matrix for two different movies that we show for the same retina. And there's high overlap in terms of the interaction that we find. I mean, so this is very different stimuli that we play. This is uniform flicker stimuli. One comes from a Gaussian distribution. The other one is a one pixel from a natural movie. So this is what we call a natural pixel movie. And we show them both to the retina, and we ask, well, how similar is the interaction matrix that we infer when we've built a model that allows each of the cells have its own receptive field, and we estimate its own kind of LN model for it. And what we find is that this gives relatively similar interaction matrices, and you can actually identify these kind of ground state that you expect to get in some ongoing activity. So if you ask for a function of time for each pattern that you see, if you map the space of patterns and ask which are these dominant activity patterns, the patterns that have higher probability, if you think about the energy landscape in the Ising model, let's identify minimum energy states and ask for each pattern which ground state it belongs to. What we find is that for different times in the stimulus, you can find dominant patterns which are being kind of repeating over and over again, even though they're all noisy versions of them. And so if you ask about the dominant, these ground state patterns over the different stimuli, you find that even though these are, you know, are very different statistics, there are very similar ground states that kind of repeat for the different stimuli. And we find this is very kind of very simple version of the similarity between ongoing activity and invoked activity that, you know, the Greenwald and Todix and Ariely showed many years ago, that you kind of have very similar patterns going on in these two cases. We kind of see similar things going on already at the retina in terms of these what seems to be like kind of stored patterns or kind of ground state things that control what's going on. So I'm going to skip the decoding side and just summarize about the fact that we find that, you know, we can actually map the joint activity of many cells with a model that has relatively, which is very sparse, low-order interaction network. Most of me, we do a very good job with pairs. If you ask me later, I'll tell you about the little stuff that we see in terms of higher-order things and how they affect things. But the main thing is that you have a sparse interaction network, which is still strong enough to have a strong effect on the network as a whole. And we can start to kind of figure out the actual architecture and identify both motifs and local structures and overlapping organizations of these networks and kind of try and figure out how does this relate to the optimal thing that you want to build. And this is just the people that did all of this. So most of the stuff I talked about, and some of it was old stuff that I was still doing with Bill and Michael in Princeton, but all the new stuff comes from Elad Ganmoren and Anat Granot in my lab, and this is the other people that contributed. Thanks for your time.